The Conquest of Nature, Chapter 13. This morning, a student put a very interesting question to me. His question is, how much freedom do we really have? Have we really any effective control over external circumstances? If we are not really slaves of circumstances, then to what extent are we free? This question is almost as old as the hills. But let us look at this problem not from an individualistic point of view, but from, let us say, a collective point of view. That is because we will be able to obtain a greater control over external circumstances if we make collective resolves instead of individual ones. What are we doing now? I set up a goal for myself and try to achieve it all by myself. It is not quite certain that the people amongst whom I live have a favorable attitude towards it. The external circumstances may also not be favorable, and in such a situation, I have to struggle all alone against my fellow beings who may have goals that are opposed to mine, against the prevailing circumstances, and against the physical world on the top of it all. I shall have thus to fight on two or three fronts at the same time. Everyone else has the same right to take independent decisions as myself. And if someone else's goal is contrary to mine, he will come into conflict with me. Under such circumstances, it becomes very difficult to achieve mastery over the world. This is almost exactly the situation in which man now finds himself. The power of science is not going to be favorable to individualistic efforts. Its help will be available to us collectively only when we make a joint resolve to strive for something. Then it will be easier to achieve mastery over the external world. It will be easier for men to cooperate with each other, and there will be a cessation of mutual conflict. Then we will fight jointly for the mastery over nature. Our victory will be aided by science, and man will no longer have any reason to feel that he is the slave of circumstances. But we must have to take the help of science to gain the confidence that we can master the external world. To this end, it will be necessary for us to decide upon our goals jointly, to strive for them jointly, not individually. And this jointly should now mean the whole of humanity. It will then be the duty of the individual to exert to the utmost for the achievement of this common goal, and he will have the satisfaction of feeling that he is working for this common purpose. Now we have the power of science at our disposal, and this power is growing day by day, so that in the future we will have more of it at our disposal than we have now. So we must make use of it freely. We can master nature if we make use of the scientific method. And then questions such as whether we are really free agents and have any control over circumstances will not arise at all. Recently, I had said that science must continue to grow and scientists must take a vow not to help in the invention and manufacture of destructive weapons. The Daily Press has welcomed my statement with the comment that it is a happy sign that these protagonists of Sarvodaya have now begun to appreciate the value of science. People have taken it for granted that these Sarvodayites are wedded to outdated modes of thought and are not in favor of scientific progress. On the other hand, those others who do not accept the Sarvodaya point of view are wedded to so many other isms, Those stalwarts of dialectics are supposed to be great lovers of scientific progress. There cannot be a greater mistake, a greater misapprehension than this. Actually, it is the believer in Sarvodaya who is fully entitled to make the freest use of science. One who does not believe in Sarvodaya, that is, one who has not the welfare of the entire humanity at heart, is not entitled to have any access to the powers that science has placed at our disposal, because science, in the control of such people, will only encompass the destruction of mankind. So nobody else in this world can welcome science as freely and as wholeheartedly as one who accepts and has complete faith in non-violence. That is why when people accept the Sarvodaya point of view and pursue science in that spirit, it will become a succouring, redeeming and divine force in the service of mankind. I know that there are some people in the Sarvodaya movement who have a good word to put in favor of traditional forms of social organization, and furthermore, who believe that it is safe to stick to traditional methods of production and dangerous to adopt modern technological innovations. But science and mechanization are not the same thing. Science, or rather technology, cannot decide as to what kind of machinery will be useful for which society. That decision has to be made by taking into consideration the social situation, the population problem, the land-to-man ratio, the employment situation, and such other factors into considerations. And different countries will come to different conclusions as to the type of machineries they will adopt. These decisions will also change with the passage of time. Today we may have to tolerate the use of certain types of machineries, but tomorrow we may or may not do so. While we may then no longer welcome such other machineries as are being welcomed by us today. This may happen in other countries also. Thus, the particular form of technology will depend upon and vary according to the prevailing circumstances. There ought not to be any question of zealotry in this. Science as such has nothing to do with the form of technology. There can be as much science in small machineries as in big. So we must have to grasp the idea that the Sarvodaya point of view accepts science completely and unreservedly. Very few people lay such great stress on the importance of science as I am doing today. Today there are many who love science, but they want to go ahead with only the love of science at heart without caring for self-knowledge. And so science leads to terrible consequences. The Sarvodaya approach is firmly based on self-knowledge, and hence it is not in the least afraid of science. Rather, it welcomes science with an open mind and is in a position to utilize it properly. So, the main idea in Sarvodaya is that the soul does not dwell in bondage, in narrowness, but is to be found in pervasiveness, in universality. That is why our decisions and endeavors ought to be collective. And then with science added unto these collective resolves, we will be able to master our circumstances. It may be too much to claim that we will be able to have complete mastery, but we can certainly be successful to a considerable extent. It is inconceivable that God, who created this world, has ordained a life of sorrow for His children. He has provided for our happiness, but we have been so enterprising that we have changed that happiness into sorrow. He gave us grapes and we turn it into wine. He gave us iron and we are making weapons out of it. Cow gives us both milk and dung, But instead of using the dung for plastering, we use it as food and plaster our walls with milk, it will be no fault of the cow. We do not know how to live correctly, and that is how we have made our lives sorrowful. I place this proposition before you, that whatever we may have, we should consider as belonging to the society as a whole, and should partake of it only after sharing it with others. This thing is an unavoidable necessity and will prove very useful in this age of science. This idea of sharing has been handed down to us through the ages. But in the scientific age, neither the individual nor the society can do without it. That is why I am placing before you the idea of joint endeavor and joint enjoyment. Only this can make us happy in this scientific age.